Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It's been a long time. America's big three automakers had great numbers to brag about this week. April sales figures, General Motors up 26% over a year ago, Ford 16%, Chrysler 22%, GM's passenger car sales up 50%. It's been a while. Of course, a year ago, that's what they're comparing to here, was a kind of perfect hell for the U.S. auto industry. They'd seen bailout, bankruptcy, then Toyota stumbled, a tsunami hit, Detroit had small cars to sell as gas soared. So what now? Could this be a real comeback? This hour, On Point, U.S. automakers and the global auto industry. You can join the conversation. Are you buying American again? Can you picture a truly revived, strong U.S. auto industry? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me today from Detroit is Michelle Krebs, senior industry analyst at the auto information website Edmunds.com. Michelle, welcome back. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Also with us today from Detroit, Neil Baudette. He's Detroit bureau chief for the Wall Street Journal. Neil, welcome to you as well.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Okay, here's these incredible numbers and more out today from GM. First quarter profits, $3.2 billion, more than tripled there. They're talking about torrid sales. Michelle, let me come first to you. I mean, when we first saw these numbers coming out, we kind of just shook our head. We're so accustomed to the U.S. auto industry being a downer. It's hard to believe this was real. We said that's just because things were so bad a year ago and Japan got knocked off course by the earthquake. But people are talking about something bigger than that, Michelle.
Well, those factors all play into it. When your enemy's down, capitalize.
You look up, yeah.
Right. But on the other hand, if you look back at 2008 when gas prices went up, or even in the 1970s, the American car companies could not capitalize on it. They simply did not have the small fuel-efficient vehicles to address the market. Well, today they do, and increasingly so. And not just in small cars, but small sport utilities and that kind of thing.
Neil, your headline in the Wall Street Journal is Pendulum Swings Back Toward Detroit. I think most Americans alive today have never seen that. They've just basically seen the pendulum swinging away for years and years and years.
I agree. I've been covering Detroit. I've been in the Detroit Bureau since 2004 and covering autos since 2002. And it's never been like this before. And really, I think we're seeing the companies are dramatically different companies than they were before. They make much better cars. They've cut their costs dramatically so that they can make money even on small cars. And so it's really not the same Detroit that we grew up with.
Michelle, the new numbers that are out this week that everybody's turning their heads on are led by small cars. Here's another kind of headline that's just baffling about the U.S. auto industry. We associate them with SUVs and, trucks leading. And here, small cars, what's the picture there, Michelle?
Well, Ford, for instance, had an amazing month with the Ford Fiesta. It's the smallest car it's ever made for the U.S. market. They had sold 9,000 of them in 1 month. That's amazing. Chevrolet has – the General Motors has the Chevrolet Cruze. They sold 25,000 of them this month. It's just phenomenal. The other thing, to go back to one of Neil's comments, is the other thing that's happening with the Japanese is they're really under pressure in profitability, not because of recalls and then because of the earthquake and such, but also because of the yen. So the Americans are in a better position that way, too.
Well, let's look at the Japanese for a second, because, I mean, ever since the, 1970s, they've just come on and come on and come on. It seemed as though that was going to go forever. Toyota toppled GM from its, most global auto sales position, though now we're seeing projections that GM will take that back this year. Neil, is this just a blip, though, in the Japanese march? I mean, we saw the terrible problems Toyota had with the accelerator claims and the recalls, a year and more ago. And then all of Japan just absolutely
whacked by the earthquake and tsunami and nuclear problems that followed. I'm looking here at numbers that say Toyota's factories in North America are even just running at 30% capacity now. They've got some holidays this week in Japan, but when they reopen, they're talking about Toyota factories only operating at a 50% rate. Is this just about a temporary, momentary setback for Japan, Neil?
Well, it's a natural disaster, but I think it's going to have longer lasting effects. I don't think it's going to go away in just a quarter or two. What you'll see happen is Toyota, Nissan, Honda, the Japanese automakers, are running their plants at low levels. So later this month into June, July, August, they'll have very few vehicles to sell in the U.S., and that will create an opening for the Detroit automakers to gain market share. And then once Toyota gets back on its feet, Nissan, Honda are back to producing at normal levels, it'll be harder than ever to regain that market share back from Detroit, because the Ford, GM, as Michelle said, they have good small cars. They have good cars up and SUVs and trucks up and down their lineup. And it will be, and they're making money. So in the eyes of consumers, these companies now look like winners. So it's going to be much harder to pull those people back once Toyota, Honda, and Nissan are back to full production.
Michelle, do you agree this is a kind of reversal of a story that's been going on for decades? Hard for Japan automakers to gain market share? It seems like that's all they've done for years and years. What about now?
Absolutely. The other thing that I would go back to is, I think during the Toyota recall, while there are a lot of people who are very loyal to the Toyota brand, there were people that said suddenly, they aren't the silver bullet of quality that I thought they were. Maybe I should consider something else. And we cannot forget that the Koreans have been a huge beneficiary. Hyundai and Kia have been tremendously considered, you know, as an alternative to Toyota and Honda, for example. But this is absolutely a golden opportunity for the Detroit automakers to capitalize on that willingness to consider something else.
But what
if
about
I could just...
Yes, Neil, please.
I just wanted to say one other thing about the Japanese is that in some ways they have come to resemble what old Detroit was. Toyota in the last decade became very, very focused on just pure volume and becoming the largest automaker in the world at the expense of quality. These days they have high manufacturing costs in Japan. They have this belief in not laying off anybody. And that's kind of similar to where the Detroit automakers were when they couldn't get rid of workers, even though they had to shut down plants. So there's a little bit of Detroit disease in Japan these days.
I want to dig in on these issues of cost and quality, but we've got listeners lining up already with their view of this. Americans have paid a lot of attention for a long time. This was the kind of hallmark industry, and then we all saw it go away. Jim in Gloucester, Massachusetts. Jim, you're on the air.
I love it. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can, Jim. What do you think?
Well, I think it's going to be I'm going to be 50 at the end of the year, and it's going to be very tough to change my mind to buy American, especially for people who in this economy, there's no way, shape, or form that you're going to change minds that all of a sudden American manufacturers are going to be better. They're scaling down maybe now cars, but it's too little too late. I mean, you start last week looking in the paper at Craigslist. Everybody wants to start dumping their SUVs. As soon as it hits $4, those papers start filling up with ads, people trying to sell their cars, looking for little Toyotas and such. And it's just what I did a year ago.
Jim, we've got the perspective. Let us pick it up. Absolutely. $4 gas, people want to get out of those SUVs. But when they do that, Michelle, what I hear you and Neil saying is there are American auto car makers now waiting with a lot of small cars. But you hear Jim there. There's the voice of decades in which Japanese quality was absolutely presumed and tested to be better. What about it? Just at a not a perception level, but a factual level now, Michelle.
Well, absolutely. You know, memories are long. You should see, I mean, we get the same kind of feedback on our website of very long memories of people who were burned by poor American quality. And there will be a segment of the population that, you know, continue to believe that and will never switch over. I mean, as I said earlier, Toyota has a very loyal audience. And you know, that just won't be changed.
But they've got 1% sales growth in April, while GM's got 27%. All the Japanese makers way behind this time. The Americans, Neil.
Yeah, that's true. What you actually saw with Nissan, Nissan had about 12% growth, but among sales to regular consumers, it was only 3%. So the Detroit automakers did really well in April, and they gained share. And it's only going to get worse. It's going to be worse this month and worse in June because the Japanese plants in Japan were shut down for almost a month because of the earthquake, and then they've had to slow production. So that means dealers right now, trucks are pulling up and not delivering very many cars to their lots, so they won't have much to sell in the weeks ahead.
But you hear Jim there saying, you know, too little, too late for the U.S. auto industry. And I think for a lot of people, this is probably the you know, deep in their craw, this idea that we can't come back in this sector. Could we?
Well, there's all varieties of opinions out there. For every person like Jim who's dead set against going back to Detroit, there are plenty out there who are saying, yeah, you know, maybe it would be good to buy American. And if their quality is good and the studies show they are, especially for Ford and some of the GM brands, yeah, all right, I'll give them a shot.
Could this be, once again, a leading manufacturing sector for the United States? Neil, Michelle?
Well, certainly we're seeing growth in manufacturing jobs, and frankly, a lot of them are growing here in Michigan. So, and you look at the south of the United States. Every major auto manufacturer has facilities there. We're going to see a new Volkswagen plant open in Tennessee. So, you know, the U.S. is becoming a stronger manufacturing base, and part of it is because it's a lower-cost place to do business.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the global auto industry and murmurs, more than murmurs at this point, of an American comeback in auto manufacturing. For people of a certain generation, it's kind of hard to believe, but there are the numbers this month. And for GM's first quarter profits, very big. Of course, the last time we looked, it was bailout and bankruptcy. Now we're seeing something else, and we're asking, could this be the beginning of a real rebound? Michelle Krebs is with us from Detroit, senior industry analyst at Edmunds.com. And Neil Bidette, also with us from Michigan, Detroit bureau chief for the Wall Street Journal, with us today from Ann Arbor. We've got lots of comments online. Tracy just says, shocked. Chris, it is hard to believe for some people. Chris says, I bought a 2011 Ford Fiesta about a month ago. Hard to beat the price. Been averaging 37 miles per gallon. Not bad for a non-hybrid. The dealer told Chris they were having trouble keeping them in stock. Maybe SUVs are finally on their way out. Let's hear from some more listeners. Jennifer in Andover, Massachusetts. Jennifer, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah. What do you know?
Well, I just can't believe you're even having this show today because I just bought 2 days ago a 2011 Buick Regal.
When was the last time you bought an American car, Jennifer?
I bought an American car after 13 years of always owning Volkswagens and Toyota.
Why did you do it?
Well, you know, it's funny. We were looking for a new car, and we were starting to feel guilty about not supporting the economy. And so my husband and I were thinking we really want to buy American this time. But we felt just like Jim, your previous caller, there's no way the quality's not going to be there. It's going to be this old fogey mobile. I didn't want it. We pulled up. We saw the Regal, and it looked so cute. It looked like nothing I'd ever seen on the road. It had all the bells and whistles as my old cars have always had. And the gas mileage was really good. And so we got in, and I couldn't really tell the difference between, you know, having a foreign car versus this really cool little car. And so we pulled the trigger, and I love it. It rides just as tight as my other cars did. And I looked online, too. We both did some research to see what were the downsides to getting the car. And honestly, the only negative that came up was that the name was Buick Regal, and that kind of brings up images of, you know, your father's old car.
The groaning old Detroit mobile, but maybe that's not any. Are you still pinching yourself, Jennifer, to think, my gosh, I just bought an American car and I'm driving it around with Buick on the label?
It's true. When I say it's a Buick Regal, I'm still kind of making the face when I say it, except the car looks like something else on the road. I pulled up to a friend's house yesterday, and she thought I'd bought an Acura. Yeah. And I was like, no, it's a Buick.
I've seen them. They're it's a hot-looking car, and you're right. The mileage.
And more importantly, it rides very tight. It's a good riding car, and every day I'm discovering a new little feature that is on par or a little bit better than what I had in my Passat.
Jennifer, I hope it serves you well and for a long, long time. I appreciate your call. One more right here. Omaha, Nebraska. Alan, you're on the air, Alan.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm going to kind of echo the thoughts of the previous caller. Mm-hmm. I gave up on Chevrolet or General Motors products in 82.
Whoa.
The last one that I owned.
30 years ago.
My point about long memories.
Yes, yes.
Yes, exactly. I'm 63.
Yep.
Last month, I traded in a Subaru for a Chevrolet Cruze. And I would say that, echoing the other caller, it is every bit as nice as any Japanese car I've ever owned. I've also owned BMWs and more expensive vehicles, Acuras and things. The Cruze is fun to drive. It's got a 1.4 turbocharged engine. It's fast. It's agile. It handles not as well, but close to my BMW 3 Series.
Wow. And what kind of mileage, Alan, are you getting there in Omaha?
It has a trip computer on it. I've only driven it in town and on the freeways. I'm getting about 30.1 miles in town.
So that's very respectable.
It is. It's great. And it has so many more features, so many subtle engineering qualities and thoughtful touches and customization features that the Subaru simply lacked. There was no comparison.
I'm still having out-of-body experience with this kind of conversation about American cars, but maybe we're going to get used to it. Alan, I appreciate your call very much. Michelle, I was in a Chevy Cruze in Austin, Texas a few weeks ago. Terrific little car. They are coming out fast and furious with those. What happened here? GM and the rest of the American automakers did not know for certain when we were going to see these super high gas prices. Did they just get lucky that $4 gas and their rollouts coincided? How'd they finally get off the SUV idea?
Well, a number of things happened. First, I think there was a tipping point in terms of the environment and the idea that, gas prices in the future are going to be higher. And I think turmoil in the Middle East and energy security became an issue. The other thing that the points that your two last callers raised were the handling and that kind of thing. One of the things that the American car companies have done, Ford and General Motors specifically, is they have tapped into their global expertise. One of the reasons you get great handling is because those chassis on that the Cruze and the Regal ride on, and I'm a big
yep.
fan of the Regal, by the way,
mm-hmm.
they come from Europe, where they really know ride and handling. They have the best engineers to do that.
Are they made there or designed there?
They're not made there, but they are the underpinnings of those vehicles
yep.
were tuned in Europe, and then they bring that technology here. For years, we have wondered, why don't we get the same wonderful Ford Focus that they have in Europe?
Yeah.
Because we had a different one. Now we get the European version, and it's far superior in terms of ride and handling.
Neil, why is that happening? American car companies have become, in a sense, global, and they're finally bringing it home. What took them so long if they've had it out there?
Well, that's a great question, and it has to do with management and labor. And in the past, management was not very smart, and labor was very difficult for the companies, and labor costs were high. And so the only way the old management thought they could way forward was to just make the cars as inexpensively as possible. So they put little money into engineering. They put little money into the materials, the fabrics, the plastics and everything.
Yep.
There's a different philosophy. Now that they've cut their costs and they've been able to lower their labor costs, they can spend more on the cars. So they put more into the engineering. They buy more luxurious feeling controls and dials and consoles. And so the cars come out dramatically better. And you've heard that exactly in the two callers about the Buick Regal and the Chevy Cruze. The Cruze is a great example. It comes with 10 airbags standard. About 8-9 years ago, GM made cars that didn't have electronic stability control, which prevents skids. It didn't come
mm-hmm.
standard. You had to pay extra for
mm-hmm.
it. And that was because they were just trying to make their cars as cheaply as possible. And it's a totally different management philosophy that they have now going forward. And obviously, it's a winning one.
How does the crisis or after 2008 or during 2008, the meltdown, factor into this? I mean, Of course, everybody knows the U.S. government came in, took that 61% ownership of GM as part of its bailout bankruptcy. Is that part of bringing the labor costs down, or is something else going on there?
Yes, very much. I mean, when they went in, GM owed a lot of cash to the retirement fund for the union. They were able to pay that in stock. They had other changes to the contract to lower the labor costs. But at the same time, and more very importantly, was that both GM and Chrysler got brain transplants. They had whole new management teams come in that had a fresh look. They were not dyed-in-the-wool, decades-old Detroiters who did things the same old way. And that's what we see here with GM. The CEO is a man who came in, Dan Akerson, did not have auto industry experience, but he has auto people around him, and they seem to be making the right decisions compared to what the old management used to do.
Neil, Michelle, please stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation from Stamford, Connecticut, Marianne Keller, analyst of the auto industry since way back in 1972, 30 years on Wall Street, president of Marianne Keller & Associates Consulting. She's author of Rude Awakening, The Rise, Fall, and Struggle for Recovery of General Motors. Marianne Keller, thanks very much for being with us.
Delighted to be here. Thanks.
So where are you on the headline front? Do you see pendulum swing, comeback, or not so sure yet?
Well, I think that the success or failure of any company is partly due to what the competition is doing. And I've listened to the conversation of your other two guests, and I agree absolutely with the comment that that Neil made, that the Japanese were becoming lethargic, bureaucratic, and frankly very slow to react. They were able to do that because we were so bad. I mean, you know, were the Japanese building such spectacularly designed cars? No. I think some people would say that their designs were a little boring.
All they had to do was be better than American cars, and that was easy for many years.
That same, it's that old story about, you know, do you have to run as fast as a bear, or do you just have to run the other outrun the other person?
Right.
And the Japanese, frankly, had a very easy comparison for many, many years. So if you look at this conversation that you're having, you have to put a little bit of it into context. The Koreans, when they first came to the United States, had awful quality. I mean, there's just no other way to describe the Hyundai Excel of the 1980s. It
right.
was a hideous car.
Mm-hmm.
Design-wise, features, the only thing it had was a cheap price, and then it promptly fell apart. That is not Hyundai and Kia today. These are really dramatically different vehicles, and clearly on the design and technology and quality front are as good as anything the Japanese produce.
Well, let me ask you, Marianne, then.
The Americans, we're there as well. So the Japanese were going to have a harder time. It's not necessarily all their fault. It's just the fact that the world has gotten, their competition has gotten better.
But let me ask you on that front then. I mean, I think people will right away look over their shoulder again, wonder about other potential overseas automakers and whether they might step right into those Japanese shoes. Could this be a false spring for American automakers? Are we going to see, I don't know, Koreans surge in with lower cost and high quality and once again undercut Americans? Or for that matter, what about Chinese-made cars? I don't know.
Well, I have, probably for the last decade, people have been saying, when are the Chinese coming? The Chinese are not ready for prime time. Chinese cars could not sell in the United States on any basis except being given away. They simply don't have the technology and the quality that Americans would expect. Now, having said that, I'd also point out that China today is the world's largest car market in terms of both sales and production. So one might say, well, why do they need to come here anyway? We're smaller, a much more competitive market with well-established brands. I don't think Americans are going to rush right out and say, oh, boy, I really want a Great Wall car or a Chery or a Geely. It costs a huge amount of money to establish a dealer network and a brand in the U.S. I think the Chinese will eventually sell cars. Chinese-produced cars will eventually be sold in the United States, but frankly, they might be sold as Chevrolets and Fords. We don't know that, but that's entirely possible as these companies develop global production.
There's so much to get our heads around here. The idea of China being the world's biggest market and biggest producer. I saw what the New York International Auto Show kind of eclipsed this year by the Shanghai Show, which happened to be the same week, and car unveilings happening there, not here. We may rebuild an industry, but finds ourselves in a very different situation anyway, and things do keep rolling. Here's news just handed to me GM is recalling all of its best-selling car, the Cruze, over issues related to the steering shaft and automatic transmission. So, I don't know, watch out for that. What a picture we're looking at here. Things really changing in the global auto industry and right here at home with the U.S. auto industry. Let's go to Peter in Brattleboro, Vermont. Peter, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi there, Tom.
Hi.
I think a major point is being missed in this entire discussion. Everyone's talking about, oh, the comeback and the competitive nature and all that sort of thing. Well, as far as the labor situation is concerned, all that had to be done in order to make the American auto industry competitive with the world in terms of its balance sheet was for the United States to take on public health care, because had you taken that line item out of the budgets of all three big three automakers, they could have continued to pay a living wage to Americans instead of decimating the workforce over a period of a decade and then coming back and saying, hey, now that we can cut your pay by 30%, 50%, we'll give you a job back. And I think that is an important point to watch.
Peter, I appreciate that call, and particularly from Vermont, where I know you all are working on big universal coverage up there. And it's Neil, come in here. I mean, we've all heard over the years, if I may, that health care costs were such a big part of the burden that Detroit automakers were carrying. Are these new GM profits built on the back of wage cuts and decimated health care, as Peter said?
No, I don't agree with the caller. Yes, health care costs were a big problem, but the labor union, the UAW, United Auto Workers, had all kinds of work rules that prevented certain workers from doing certain jobs, and it made created a lot of jobs for people to do things that had nothing to do with auto production, and there were just all these very complicated work rules that were very, very costly. There were other issues too, besides healthcare, that had to be fixed, and most of them have been addressed, but there are still costs to be reduced. I mean, current active UAW workers only pay about 5% of their health care costs out of their own pocket, whereas for most American workers, it's 25 or 30%.
Marianne Keller, do you see this U.S. auto industry comeback, if that's what it is, being built on the back of workers and their health care and their wages?
Not at all. For the most part, wages were untouched. There is a two-tier wage structure in place, however,
that is, new employees are not going to make what their father's generation made.
Right, but that wage structure only applies to new hires. It doesn't apply to people who were on board when that was put into effect.
But still, that's the future of the workforce. That's their new framework.
I guess I would say this. The UAW negotiates every 3-4 years with the auto industry, and my guess is that the auto industry, if it remains as profitable, or the auto companies, if they remain as profitable as they are right now, I think that the UAW would demonstrate the same history that it has had in the past, which is to go after clawing back the concessions that they've made in all areas, and they frankly have stated that. So, you know, the moment that Alan Mulally has, stock grants that have appreciated to the extent that they have, there's a hue and cry in Detroit saying, we're going to get our share too. You know, we're not going to let one person get rich at our expense. I think that so the UAW has practiced that philosophy for many, many years, so I certainly disagree with your caller. Having said that about health care, I agree with what Neil said. Health care was a problem for this industry. The health care costs for the existing retirees has been put into a VEBA, and it is the VEBA that actually owns the equity stakes in the auto company.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about the U.S. auto industry, maybe almost unbelievably, in comeback mode after so many years and such deep problem. Sales way up at GM, at Ford, even Chrysler, 50% up for GM when it comes to passenger cars. And those smaller passenger cars they're now making, that's what's selling. More news just keeps coming in. Here's GM saying they're going to spend $130 million to gear up their Kentucky plant, Bowling Green, for the next generation Corvette. More expansion there. Michelle Krebs is with us today from Detroit, senior industry analyst at auto information website Edmunds.com. Neil Baudette is with us from Ann Arbor, Michigan, Detroit bureau chief for the Wall Street Journal. Marianne Keller joins us from Stamford, Connecticut, author of Rude Awakening and Collision. She's been following the auto industry for a long, long time. Let's go to our listeners, Josh in Boston. Josh, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I have to say that I'm very excited, and perhaps I should say emboldened by the news coming out of Detroit. I'd say I've been on the market, the car market, if you will, for about 15 years now, and during that time, I've always wanted to buy American. We try to buy American in all parts of our life and our home. My wife actually is a union organizer, and she's always pushing to buy American as well. But for the car industry, it's never worked out for us because they've never been able to measure up in terms of quality, in terms of cost and mileage. And certainly, we have a family, we have some kids, and the old SUVs, like the old Ford Explorers, were very clunky and kind of ugly. And
yeah.
I'm actually, now that I'm searching for a new car, I've actually been buying Honda and Toyota for a good at least 10 years now. And I know that you said that there's a big jump in the small car market, but the Ford Explorer, the new Ford Explorer, looks awesome too.
And I think it's a lighter weight one as well that they're putting out now. But it's still an SUV. Do you look at the mileage, Josh, or where's your eye go first?
I look at the mileage, and the new mileage for the Ford Explorer is much more competitive, especially in terms of the size and what we need, and sort of carting our two kids and all the junk that we need for that around. And in terms of what you were mentioning before, or the analyst was mentioning before about fit and finish, it just looks better. It looks better on the inside. It rides tighter. It looks nicer, and it's something that, with all things being equal, with quality being equal, with efficiency being equal as the, you know, on par with the foreign market, I'd love to buy American, and am very happy to be looking now at American vehicles for my next purchase.
Josh, I appreciate
Tom, can I jump in
yes,
there?
Yes, Michelle. Yes, please, Michelle. Thanks,
the
Josh.
One of the big changes in the new Ford Explorer is the fact that it no longer is built on a truck architecture. It is shifted to a car architecture, which automatically makes it lighter, makes it more nimble, and that's what's delivering the good fuel economy. It's a terrific vehicle.
What about this ratio of SUV, truck-based vehicles versus auto? How's that changing overall in the U.S. auto industry, Michelle? They seem so trapped in SUV land in the 90s, just couldn't get out of it. Where does that stand? Where's it headed?
Well, we have shifted much more to car-based SUVs, and I use that term loosely.
Mm-hmm.
Some people call them crossovers. But we're seeing Chevy Equinox, for example. Those are all based on cars so that they, you know, you get this nimble handling, this lighter feel, and you get much better fuel economy. And the industry is moving that way.
Marianne Keller, can we bring this back to cost structure for a moment? I mean, there's so many deeply embedded ideas here that have built up over years, but one is that the U.S. just can't compete on cost, that you put everything together and we're up against lower-wage competitors abroad who, whatever we do, are going to come in and eat our lunch. What's happened on that front, Marianne?
Well, I think there's a number of things. First, bankruptcy did solve the debt problem that both GM and Chrysler had, and Ford has been successfully paying down its debt. So the interest expense and the leverage that these companies suffered from in the past has now been substantially mitigated. On the labor front, our labor costs, especially now that the health care costs, at least for GM and Chrysler, have been resolved for retirees through the VEBA, are now quite competitive with Japan. And as Neil pointed out earlier, the yen is now hovering around 80, which makes manufacturing in Japan very, very expensive. It is not competitive. So as a country, today we certainly have more attractive overall costs than other regions that in the past benefited from a favorable currency as well as lower local wages. That's no longer the case. So the U.S. as a manufacturing or vehicle assembly operation has certainly gained attractiveness. If you're going to sell cars here, it's certainly more beneficial to produce them here.
And Neil Baudet, so we're not going to see, I don't know, Vietnam or Brazil or, you know, who knows, India, Bangladesh sort of step up and become the next export challenge to Detroit, Neil?
I don't think so. Brazil produces a lot of cars now and is actually a fairly uncompetitive in terms of cost. Mm-hmm. There are plants in places like Thailand, but those vehicles aren't going to be shipped to the U.S. And as Michelle was saying, and Marianne was saying, the U.S. is very attractive. You look at this VW plant that's going to have its ceremonial opening later this month.
Where?
Near Chattanooga, Tennessee. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That plant is going to make half of the vehicles made there will be sold in the U.S. The other half will be exported, because the U.S. is a low-cost or a competitive country for producing cars and selling them in other regions. And BMW has a plant in South Carolina. It supplies vehicles that the company ships, exports to around the world. It's the largest exporter of vehicles in the U.S., of U.S.-made vehicles, is BMW.
Michelle?
In fact, that plant just expanded. I was there for the expansion. That is the only plant that builds the small X3 SUV that BMW makes, which is shipped around the world. And let's not forget the Mercedes plant in Alabama, which is going to, next year or so, move the high-volume Mercedes-Benz C-Class to the U.S. To supply the market here as well as for export.
U.S. is a competitive automaker again. Amazing. Yeah, Neil?
I should note about the South Carolina plant. BMW has a combination of permanent and temporary employees, but in total, that plant is envisioned to eventually employ 7,000 people, which would make the largest manufacturing plant in the U.S. 7,000 jobs, that's quite a bit, and it's a signal that BMW sees the U.S. as a very competitive place to make cars.
So permanent and temporary, we're listening to all these nuances and wondering about, you know, the families who are making their livings here as well. Augusta, Georgia, Carrie, you're on the air, Carrie.
Hi, I'm in my 20s, and I've had a Ford and a Chevy, and currently I drive a Nissan.
Okay.
And the experience I had with my Ford and Chevy was incredibly negative. It left me stranded hundreds of miles from home in zero-degree weather back in Minnesota. I don't trust American cars, and I will never trust American cars.
Carrie, let me just, if I may, just ask, were those new Fords and Chevys, or were they, you know, from the bummer years? What?
No, they were from the bummer years. Of the two, my Ford was definitely more reliable. My Chevy, I had for about a year, and I had to get rid of it.
Do you remember what year those cars were, just out of curiosity?
One was a 94 and one was a 98, though I can't remember which one was which.
Right. You're just not coming back. We hear it. Neil, there's Carrie. She had a 94 and a 98 U.S. made. She doesn't want to do it again. Is it different now or not?
Yeah. Yes, very different. I mean, those were back in the dark ages of Detroit quality. And but today, if you look at J.D. Power or the other quality surveys, the U.S. automakers have scores that are better than what Toyota had 8, 9, 10 years ago. Ford is very close to the top. GM is getting there. But the gap between the very best and somebody who's in the above average is very, very narrow. And it's almost, I wouldn't say negligible, but it's not enough to worry people about.
Carrie, I don't know. Maybe David in Williamstown, Massachusetts. David, you're on the air.
Hi, folks. Listen, I want to just say I come from a GM family. When I was a kid growing up, my father managed a dealership. My uncle worked out in Flint, Michigan. And we still buy an awful lot of GM cars. But I'm concerned about the financing. There's been no discussion here, discussion of that. I mean, I would love to jump in. I'm really excited. But I'm skeptical. We're probably still borderline cynical in our family. I can't afford to go out and buy a new car. I just went and looked at Cruises. And just for a lease, bare bones,
yeah,
$225 to $250, I made less than $25,000 last year. I'd love to know if the numbers are lease versus buy, or the 25,000 Cruises that were sold last year, how does that actually break out? I just saw on the internet last night that incentives and rebates are dropping down to their lowest levels already.
Right.
How deep is the pool of eligible buyers going down the road, given what the economy is, the difficulty in getting bank loans,
well,
et cetera, et cetera. This is a really one-sided, almost, I'd say, borderline highbrow discussion that's going on.
Well, yes and no. I mean, the sales numbers are there. On the other hand, you're entirely correct, and I saw, Michelle, that the average car on the road in the United States is now 10 years old, which I think is the oldest ever. That means a lot of people aren't, I guess, not able to flip into something new. But what about our question there, Michelle?
Well, that's absolutely true. We are at historic levels of the age of vehicles on the road. And to his point, we are seeing prices increase. It's very simple principles of supply and demand. When you've got the crews selling like that, you know, there's going to be no break on price and no less haggling at the dealership. We saw incentives drop to their lowest level in since 2005, just this past month, and we expect that will continue. But because production's not there, and without Toyota and Honda, you know, flooding the market with vehicles, that obviously allows price increases. I'd suggest, as advice to consumers, is maybe you want to hold off till fall when more inventory's on the ground.
Marianne Keller, what about the buying power of the American market, the American consumer? How does that factor in here now? We've still got pretty high unemployment and all the rest.
Right. I think your caller really has a question that breaks into two parts. First, on the issue of credit. Credit from all financial institutions is now becoming much more available. A year ago, and that's probably, by the way, one of the main reasons why car sales have been up so much in the last 6 months, because lenders have realized that people don't default on their car loans as readily as they do on their credit cards and mortgages.
Yep.
You need a car to get to work.
Right.
You'll generally pay your car loan ahead of anything else. So they're today much more willing to lend to people with FICO scores in the mid-600 range, whereas a year ago, probably you had to have a FICO score of maybe 720 to get a car loan. Now, having said that, on the pricing front, I think what the caller is thinking about is the days when the auto companies had excess capacity and high fixed labor costs, and so they were motivated to just pump cars out of the factory and then give them away with $5,000 rebates or $199 leases. I think those days are gone forever. And, you know, when you look at the impact that those artificial price reductions had on the market, that's what took car sales up to 17 million. We're not going to see 17 million for a long time to come, because now we're in a situation where capacity has been rebalanced to a large extent.
We're looking at 13 million or so car sales
this
year.
That's right. Mm-hmm. And the auto companies are seeing cost escalation. Commodity prices are up. Parts manufacturers are more able to pass through higher raw material prices in their contracts. General Motors saw it in their numbers. That's what they said this morning when they published
their profit report.
Their earnings. Ford commented on the fact that costs are rising. That's going right through to the consumer. People are going to have to get used to the fact that cars are no longer going to cost them $200 a month.
And not least, you've said, Marianne, because of all those Chinese buyers out there, that their middle class is big as our population now, their auto market bigger, that is putting pressure on commodity prices all over the world for steel and copper, everything else that goes into a car. In a way, we're competing now with Chinese buyers for those raw materials that go in here.
That's right. And you know, inevitably, China, having entered the global automotive scene, has now demand for raw materials, as you mentioned, that's equal to ours. And there's only so much copper produced in the world. There's only so much cast iron, steel, aluminum, et cetera. And they're now actively bidding for these products as much as we are. So what can people do? Well, you know, those $45,000 SUVs, fewer people can afford them, because the deals are not going to be there, so they're going to have to buy less expensive cars when they go into the market. And as Michelle has been pointing out, today's small cars are much more attractive, so you're not going to feel like, you know, you're trading down to something that's,
right,
that's inferior.
Right.
You know, we're probably going to be buying smaller houses in the future as well. But, you know, this is simply a fact of life. We're now in a global marketplace for automobiles, very different than the one when Western Europe and North America dominated industrial production. I should add Japan in there. But
yeah, a little smaller but better quality. This may not be the worst thing, Neil Badette. And who knows, for all I know, styling may start to be determined in China as well. We're going to have chopstick holders in our cars, Neil.
Well, what Marianne was saying relates to a very fundamental question, which is how big is the U.S. car market? And it's not really clear. 10 years ago, it seemed like it was 17 million cars a year,
mm-hmm,
vehicles, cars and light trucks, sold in the U.S. a year. Right now, we're on a track to sell about 13 million. And the question is, do we ever really get back to 17 million? When we were selling that many, GM, Ford, Chrysler were pumping a lot of cars into rental fleets. They were selling cars with huge discounts. Now that cars are more expensive, maybe the U.S. market is only 14 million or 15 million or 16 million. We don't know. But all of those costs that Marianne was talking about, making cars more expensive, will limit it. And, of course, that limits the profit possibility and the growth in the market.
Still, in the black beats in the red. You know, sales figures up beat sales figures down. And this quality talk is a kind of whole new narrative, really, finally, it sounds like, maybe taking hold here. We are out of time right there, but what an interesting reversal of fortunes, maybe. We're going to continue to watch it. Neil Badette with The Wall Street Journal in Ann Arbor today. Thank you so much for being with us, Neil.
Pleasure to be here. Thanks, Tom.
Marianne Keller at Marianne Keller & Associates in Stamford, Connecticut. Thank you, Marianne.
Thank you.
And Michelle Krebs with Edmunds.com. Michelle, it's always great to have you. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
Listeners, thanks for being here. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.